Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Welcome to the sixth talk of Mindfulness Where Dharma Meets Practice. This is the second and concluding talk on the topic Living in Devotion. Last week, we talked about refuge and the physical and mental ways we practice refuge as a motivator for our practice. Let me quickly add a word about historically later devotional practices found in Buddhism. Devotional practices in early Buddhism seem to have been simple, minimal, and functionally motivated as a support for the Noble Eightfold Path. In most later traditions, devotional practices seem to have, in general, continued to center around refuge, but to have blossomed into something much more elaborate and often freely mixed with elements of folk culture, for instance, with ancestor worship or with blessings for good fortune. After the Buddha's demise, veneration of the Buddha continued in ways that involved stupas, bodhi trees, fabricated footprints of the Buddha, and after many centuries, Buddha statues. These were commonly augmented through ritual offerings of food, incense, and water. Some schools like Pure Land Buddhism and modern Soka Gakkai are fundamentally devotional, much like possibly the preponderance of world religions. My own sense is that these devotional elaborations are, for the most part, innocuous, for they strengthen refuge and rarely contradict Buddhist principles. It behooves us to respect the many exotic flavors of Buddhist devotional practice, but it is not necessary to practice them ourselves. They may satisfy a human need for devotional expression not fully supported in the early Buddhist texts. Let me now change gears. I mentioned that when we take refuge in the Dharma or devote ourselves to Dharmic practice, we're not buying into a belief system. I want to talk now about the importance of taking the Dharma seriously while holding it loosely. Most people are rightly wary, particularly in the scientific age, of placing trust in an ancient system of beliefs. It's appropriate at this juncture to come to a better understanding of the nature of the Dharma. It's particularly important to understand that it is not a system of beliefs, but represents a middle way between conviction and skepticism that promotes our own process of experiential discovery. In brief, the Dharma is something we gradually make our own until eventually trust is no longer necessary. We don't need to be so wary in the case of Dharma. The main emphasis of the Dharma is on the mind. It deals with the human dilemma, existential crisis, anguish, suffering, and dissatisfaction, delusion, misperception, selfishness, harmfulness, meaninglessness, and the rest. It treats these as human problems with human causes that arise in human minds, problems that require human solutions. The Dharma provides a program whereby the mind is tuned, honed, sharpened, tempered, straightened, turned, and distilled into an instrument of virtue, serenity, and wisdom. The Dharma itself is among the greatest products of the human mind, skillfully articulated by the Buddha. The Dharma stands out in its economy. The Buddha characteristically took care not to teach more than was necessary. As a result, he carefully avoided useless speculation about topics irrelevant to the understanding or practice of the Dharma. This method is made clear in the handful of leaves simile. What do you think, monks? Which are the more numerous, the few leaves I have here in my hand, or those up in the trees of the grove? Lord, the fortunate one is holding only a few leaves. Those up in the trees are far more numerous. In the same way, monks, there are many more things I have found out but not revealed to you. What I have revealed to you is only a little. And why, monks, have I not revealed it? Because, monks, it is not related to the goal, it is not fundamental to the holy life, does not conduce to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, tranquility, higher knowledge, awakening, or nirvana. That is why I have not revealed it. Recall that the doctrine of the Buddha is only useful insofar as it promotes skillful practice. The resulting agnosticism with regard to many religious views and folk beliefs gives Buddhism its characteristic tolerance that allows it to blend easily with the presuppositions of various cultures, that is, insofar as these do not contradict the purpose of Dharma. For instance, whether one believes in tree spirits or in the flying spaghetti monster doesn't really matter, as long as these beliefs are compatible with virtue and practical wisdom and do not obstruct serenity. On the other hand, the Buddha did not hesitate to criticize views that detract from spiritual development. One of these is annihilationism, the widely held view that nothing remains, including our karmic results, after the death of the body. The problem is that this view limits our willingness to take responsibility for the future. Another is eternalism, the opposing view that some essence or soul survives death. The problem is that this view promotes obsession. The middle way that he advocated led between these views. The Dharma also stands out in its empirical quality, pointing almost entirely to what can be verified in our direct experience. Many people in the West are inspired to trust the Dharma in the first place upon learning of this refreshing see-for-yourself quality of the Dharma. But some caution is called for. We should not think this means that we should trust our own experience above all else. In fact, for the Buddha, the typical uninstructed worldling, most of us, is actually astonishingly deluded. Most of us get hopelessly confused in trying to see, much less interpret, our own experience. Trying to verify the Dharma against those experiences is that much more difficult. The Kalama Sutta warns us not to see certainty in one's own thinking, nor in much of anything else. Come, Kalamas, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeating hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon repetition, nor upon what is in scripture, nor as a result of thought, nor upon an axiom, nor upon careful reasoning, nor out of delight in speculation, nor upon another seeming ability, nor upon the thought, the monk is our venerable teacher. Kalamas, when you yourselves know these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken as a whole, these things lead to benefit and happiness, then enter on and abide in them. Elsewhere, it is suggested that effort is required to verify the Dharma against experience, since Dharma is personally experienced by the wise. The Buddha invites us to come and see, but when he says come, he is shouting down to us flatlanders from the mountaintop. To arrive at his vantage point, we need to scramble up hills, struggle through brambles and ford creeks. When the Buddha says see, we need to focus our eyes intently in the right direction to barely make out what the Buddha sees with great clarity of vision. In order to be willing to do all of this, we have to establish from the beginning trust that the Buddha knew what he was talking about. This is refuge. What else would induce us to make the difficult climb up the mountain? Investigation and personal verification are necessary parts of following the dharmic path, but they take time and effort before we can say, I have come and now I see. Until then, trust is essential. Come is based on trust, and see is the eventual verification in our own experience. For instance, the Buddha taught that craving is the origin of suffering, which is the second noble truth. At first, this may seem, at least to some, to be an abstract proposition, which we must ponder and try our darndest to match up with the observation. The most likely hasty outcome is to dismiss this proposition as simply mistaken. It seems clear to us, for instance, that buying titanium cufflinks would make us exceedingly dashing and that would lead to improved prospects for romance and other forms of social and perhaps even business success. Therefore, we conclude, craving clearly leads not to suffering but to happiness. This is where taking seriously comes in. Taking Dharma seriously is refuge in the Dharma, trust that the Buddha saw things rightly. Refuge entails that we decide to trust the Dharma before we draw naive or premature conclusions from our own experiences or from what we naively think the Dharma says. This may require that we put aside our pre-Buddhist preconceptions or presuppositions. These are our tacit assumptions, often instilled at a young age before our faculty of discrimination had fully developed and not questioned since. Eventually, perhaps after years of investigation, on and off the cushion, we might discover that the second noble truth is not complex at all. It's something that bites us on the nose over and over all day, every day. We begin to notice that as soon as craving comes up, even in its simplest forms, the suffering is right behind it, as immediate as a shadow. In fact, as soon as we need to have titanium cufflinks, there is stress and anxiety, unmistakably. We might discover we have been living in a world of incessant suffering, a world of flame, all along without noticing it. In brief, what we trust the Buddha to have seen rightly bears a causal relationship to what we see for ourselves, such that practice turns trust into wisdom. Now, trust here is not about belief. Holding Dharma loosely is a quality of mindfulness, whereby we do not think only this is true, anything else is worthless. That is, we don't believe the Dharma, rather we accept it as an adaptable working assumption. What we hold loosely has much the quality of a question as of an answer. In fact, notice that in the passage from the Kalama Sutta earlier, the ultimate criterion for evaluating the worth of a teaching is ethical or practical. That is, whether practice on the basis of the teaching is of benefit, not whether only this is true, anything else is worthless. In the Chanki Sutta, we learn that anything accepted through faith, approval, oral tradition, reasoning, or pondering may or may not turn out to be true. At this, the young Brahmin Chanki asks how then truth is to be preserved. If a person has trust, his statement, this is my trust, preserves the truth, but he doesn't yet come to the definite conclusion that only this is true, anything else is worthless. To this extent, there is the preservation of the truth. To this extent, one perceives the truth. I describe this as the preservation of the truth, but it is not yet the discovery of the truth. The Buddha then repeats this formula about trust with regard to approval, oral tradition, reasoning, analogy, and pondering out. The only thing that is certain is that things are uncertain. Nothing is to be believed unconditionally, and so blind faith cannot arise under the Buddha's instructions. The Buddha then shows how truth is discovered and then finally realized, the implication being that if a proper teaching is accepted as a working assumption, it will eventually become something seen directly, that is, be known for oneself with wisdom as one's practice progresses. What mindfulness bears in mind is not frozen truths, but malleable or workable working assumptions that the practitioner will further shape to match experience as they are better understood through practice. Eventually, they will become fully internalized as a matter of direct perception. At this point, trust serves no further purpose. The last passage is a remarkable illustration of the care with which the Buddha made use of trust and other ways of accepting that which falls short of realization in direct experience. A sense of legacy. We humans like to find meaning in that which is bigger than us. For instance, seeing oneself as a member in a long family history gives us a sense of purpose. This legacy is a source of energy, responsibility, and devotion, and these shape our attitudes and behaviors in significant ways. Higher meaning for the scientist is found in contributing to the forward march of human knowledge. Higher meaning in many religions can come with seeing oneself in the service of God. The meanings we find are not necessarily wholesome. Presumably, ruthless emperors find meaning in expanding and perpetuating their empires through conquest. The eminent psychiatrist Viktor Frankl was a Holocaust survivor. He observed that an important predictor of the survival of inmates in death camps was what kind of future lay beyond the barbed wire. What was there to live for? This would include surviving family members. Frankl himself looked forward to completing his disrupted research. Meaning is a great selfless motivator. It is an essential aspect of devotion. It carries our practice along like a log in a great river. Have you known artists who cannot not do art, or musicians who cannot not do music? There are also scientists and scholars who cannot not do science or scholarship. One way Buddhists find meaning is in promoting Buddhist teaching for society at large and for future generations. Another way Buddhists find meaning is through an understanding of the epic nature of practice. This is expressed in this verse. All my ancient twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. I first encountered this verse in an early Zen meditation retreat in the spring of 1998. My first suspicious thought on hearing this was, oh, someone is trying to push the rebirth thing. Now, at this time, I viewed practice as a matter of how I meet the present. It had little to do with past and future. Practice was for me like a new office job in which my task is to take documents, let's say insurance claims, mindfully, one by one, from the inbox, process them, and place the results in the outbox. That would let me remain totally in the present, as I was told I was supposed to. I was also told that a future paycheck was forthcoming. However, the next morning, while we were once again intoning this verse, I discovered that my eyes had unaccountably teared up and that I had a lump in my throat. It got so that it was hard for me to croak along with the words. Every morning after that, I had the same response. What was going on? Somehow the meaning of this verse had struck me to the core. It felt as if my whole bungled karmic past, the mistakes I had made, the people I had hurt, the opportunities and energy I had squandered were suddenly laid bare, and it seemed clear that they extended far back beyond memory into ancient times as accumulation of karmic results that loomed menacingly and inescapably behind me, around me, and in me. The outlook that came from this was a sense of karmic continuity. It was like learning from an office colleague that the person who had had my job processing insurance claims before me was so lazy and so terribly behind in his work that he had routinely taken handfuls of documents from the inbox and stored them in the adjacent room for eventual processing. Looking in the adjacent room, I discovered an alarming backlog of boxes of unprocessed documents, along with bundles of still more documents tied together with twine, stacked up high, bundle on bundle, box on box, and bundle on box. I realized that there was suffering in the form of an unpaid claim in each of these pending documents. Dismay toward a bungled past brings with it an urgent sense of responsibility toward a still untainted future. I would have to put in many overtime hours on my shift to make sure these valid claims were paid. Amazingly, the quality of my Buddhist practice changed a lot after avowing my ancient twisted karma. Suddenly, I was doing more than trying to sustain purity of mind moment by moment. I was engaged in a cosmic battle with terrible, ancient, twisted, karmic forces that threaten the future. Standing at the gateway between past and present, I was boldly proclaiming, staff in hand, "You shall not pass." Did I now believe in rebirth? I could see that I was on to something very real, but did not feel I needed to analyze it into any more specific terms. This is the brilliance of taking seriously, but holding loosely. Perhaps practice will lead to further analysis, perhaps not. But what the hell, it sure supercharged my practice. It gave it a lot of meaning. It is in these terms that the Buddha addressed skeptics of rebirth, that is, in terms of human benefit, not in terms of only this is true, anything else is worthless. The Buddha gives us an example of an unskilled viewpoint. There are some contemplatives and Brahmins who hold this doctrine, hold this view. There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. There is no fruit or result of good or bad actions. There is no this world, no next world, no mother, no father, no spontaneously reborn beings, no Brahmins or contemplatives who, faring rightly and practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next after having directly known and realized it for themselves. This viewpoint denies karma and its fruits, the roles of giving and responsibility, refuge in the higher realization of others, and rebirth into another, hopefully more felicitous world. The Buddha points out that this viewpoint, whether true or false, is likely to condition the behavior of such contemplatives and Brahmins in an unskillful way. It can be expected that they will adopt and practice these three unskillful activities: bad bodily conduct, bad verbal conduct, bad mental conduct. Why is that? Because those venerable contemplatives and Brahmins do not see in unskillful activities the drawbacks, the degradation, and the defilement, nor in skillful activities the benefit of renunciation as cleansing. Here's the kicker. A person of this view cannot win, whether their view turns out to be true or false, in the end. Assume that there is no other world. This good person is still criticized in the here and now by the observant as a person of bad habits and wrong understanding, one who holds to a doctrine of non-existence. On the other hand, if there really is a next world, then this venerable person has made a bad throw twice, in that he is criticized by the observant here and now, and in that with the breakup of the body after death, he will be reborn in a plane of deprivation. Thus, this incontrovertible teaching, when poorly grasped and poorly adopted by him, covers one side. He gives up the skillful option. Fundamentally, this describes a purely pragmatic condition for accepting one of two alternative viewpoints on the basis of a kind of cost-benefit analysis, or we might say a means of covering one's bets. But this by itself justifies its acceptance as a kind of working assumption. The Buddha makes a similar argument in the Kalama Sutta with regard to realizing the fruits of karma in the next life. It's clear that he recommends that karma and rebirth be accepted as working assumptions by the skeptical. He seems, by the way, at the same time confident that their truth will eventually be discovered and finally realized in the diligent practitioner's own experience. The practitioner may find the discovery is of something other than what he expected.
Further resources related to this course, Mindfulness, Where Dharma Meets Practice, are available at Sitagu, that is Sitagu, sitagu.org/shortlinks/mindful.